Good morning and happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and welcome back to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode on Thursday, November 28th, 2024, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We will focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In today's episode, here are some of the stories we'll be reading. Arizona voters said yes to abortion rights, but old restrictions are still on the books. Fontes vows to work on election funding speed. Arizona certifies 2024 election results. Fontes said election denial is, quote, dead. Congressman Gosar's newsletter features a conspiracy theory tied to anti-Semitism. Eight Supreme Court applicants advance to screening panel interviews. After online attacks against her by an incoming school board member, a Mesa teacher is suing. And let's get started. Our first story, Arizona voters said yes to abortion rights, but old restrictions are still on the books. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, November 26, 2024. Arizonans overwhelmingly voted to make abortion a fundamental right, but overturning the state's current 15-week gestational ban and multiple other anti-abortion laws still on the books isn't automatic. Just an hour after she joined Governor Katie Hobbs, Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, and Arizona Supreme Court Chief Justice Ann Timmer on Monday to certify the results of the 2024 election, Attorney General Chris Mays said that officially nullifying the 15-week ban will need to take place in the courts. And she added, while her office considers the certification of Prop 139, the abortion rights ballot measure that netted more than 60% of the vote, as sufficient to restore access to the procedure, the reality is that some providers might continue to hesitate until legal protections are more firmly established. The position of the state of Arizona is that the passage of Prop 139 makes the 15-week ban unconstitutional, she said during a news conference held to celebrate the ballot measure's success. As of 10:12 a.m., when the governor signed the certification, it became unconstitutional. That is a separate matter from whether doctors and providers will be comfortable performing abortions after 15 weeks. The gestational ban outlaws abortions beyond its deadline unless a doctor deems one is necessary to preserve a woman's life or prevent the impairment of a, quote, major bodily function. Doctors who violate the 2022 law passed by legislative Republicans face the suspension of their medical license and a Class 6 felony, which could result in a prison sentence between 4 months and 2 years. Prop 139, meanwhile, prohibits the prosecution of abortion providers and allows the procedure to be performed until fetal viability, generally considered to be around 23 and 24 weeks. It also includes an exception for abortions performed past that point if a provider makes a good faith judgment that one is necessary to safeguard a woman's life, physical, or mental health. Dr. Paul Isaacson, the co-owner of one of a handful of private abortion clinics in the Valley, said he expects a lawsuit to be filed soon, aimed at rescinding the gestational ban. Isaacson has been part of multiple lawsuits challenging the legality of Arizona's anti-abortion laws, including the 1864 near-total abortion ban that was briefly revived earlier this year, and a 2021 law that banned abortions performed because of fetal genetic abnormalities. He offered a cautious view of the future of abortion care in Arizona, saying that the focus is now on what happens in the courts. The legal advice I'm getting is that we'll file a viable lawsuit and hope that we get a very quick resolution to it, he said. Among the laws Isaacson said he would like to see invalidated in the wake of Prop 139's success are the fetal genetic abnormality ban, a mandatory 24-hour waiting period, and an, quote, informed consent law that requires providers to speak with patients about alternatives to abortion, including adoption as well as the father's financial responsibility. Mays said her office expects a lawsuit challenging the legality of the 15-week law to be filed as soon as Monday, and said the state of Arizona would side with those seeking to restore access. But the work to untangle and void the rest of Arizona's anti-abortion laws will likely stretch into the next few years, she said. And she added, her office also plans to fend off attacks to reproductive rights from the federal government. Allies of President-elect Donald Trump have signaled an interest in mobilizing a series of dormant federal laws from 1873 to eradicate abortion care across the country, although Trump has said decisions on abortion should be left up to the states. The Comstock Act of abortifacients and could be used to block the transport of abortion pills. In Arizona, more than half of all abortions are medication abortions. Trump has also said he would be open to revoking the FDA approval of mifepristone, the abortion pill used in the vast majority of medication abortions. Mays, who campaigned on a promise to protect abortion access and has previously mobilized her office to join lawsuits in support of mifepristone, said that she would oppose efforts from the incoming administration to infringe on the will of Arizona voters. My office and the state of Arizona will fight that tooth and nail, she said. We will not allow that to happen. For now, the decision of Arizona voters to protect abortion care remains intact, and that voter-protected shield was cause for celebration from state leaders and local providers. Arizonans said in this election that they had had enough of these out-of-touch politicians trying to force their beliefs on us and make medical decisions for us. With the power of our votes, we made our voices heard, Hobbs said. In the aftermath of the rescinded federal protections, reproductive rights advocates warned that hostile states could see their number of medical providers shrink. And studies appear to bear that out. A review of residency applications across the country by the Association of American Medical Colleges found that anti-abortion states received far fewer applications from future OBGYNs and emergency physicians. In Arizona, the number of OBGYN applications plummeted by 26.4% in the 2023-2024 application year, the worst rate in 5 years. Dr. Misha Pengasa, an OBGYN based in Mesa, said that the early support for Prop 139 helped convince her to return to the state she grew up in after hesitating when Roe v. Wade was toppled by the U.S. Supreme Court more than 2 years ago. I really didn't know if I could practice medicine in a place where politics ruled over medicine in such a huge way, she said. I didn't know if this was the place where I could have the confidence to build my own family. For Morgan Finkelstein, who was forced to travel out of state to receive abortion care, Prop 139 is a critical protection for Arizona women across the state and in the future, who may suffer complicated pregnancies. In 2020, even when the procedure was still a federal right, Finkelstein experienced firsthand the limited access to abortion care in Arizona, when the only in-state provider who could help her when one of her twins was discovered to have a fatal heart defect couldn't fit her into their schedule. In the end, Finkelstein was able to obtain a multi-fetal pregnancy reduction in California, but not until after spending stressful days waiting for an appointment and spending thousands of dollars to receive necessary medical care. My pregnancy and birth was traumatic enough without having to leave Arizona for critical health care that was even technically legal at the time, she said. Our overall sense of safety and basic human dignity was compromised by the state we love and call home. And yet, it could have been so much worse. The passage of Prop 139 means that countless expectant mothers in a situation like mine won't have to experience my nightmare, or worse. And that concludes this first story. Arizona voters said yes to abortion rights, but old restrictions are still on the books. Our next story, Fontes vows to work on election funding speed. The Secretary of State says he won't support sacrificing access or accuracy for faster results. By Jen Fifield of VoteBeat, November 26, 2024. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, a Democrat, granted VoteBeat an interview about the state's 2024 election just before he met with Governor Katie Hobbs and Attorney General Chris Mays on November 25th to certify the results. His answers have been edited for clarity and length. Question: so how did it go? Answer: the election went very, very well. I think the voters know that because they're not paying much attention anymore. So no controversies to speak of. Basically, we had some of the same concerns that every election has. A little hiccup here, a minor hiccup there, very localized in some of the counties. Other than that, statewide, we did really well, and I think our preparations paid off. Question: where's the protest this time around? Where are the accusations of fraud? Answer: well, there are none, because election denialism is, I think, officially dead. We've shown that using the same systems, the same technology, the same people in the same state, even with the same candidates, the voters can make a different pick. And that's just where we're at. So I think the movement of election denialism is going to be pretty desperate to find any more gas in their tank. Question: is it because Trump won? Answer: it might be. But even if we had the same kinds of questions about the integrity of the election, I think they'd have the same lack of evidence, because none of the questions that have been asked before had any evidence behind them. None of the allegations of fraud before had any evidence behind them. So I guess you can say Arizona's election system stands vindicated again. Question: we saw delays in processing cast ballots because of the two-card ballot. Do you think the county is sufficiently staffed for that, or did they not think ahead on that point? Answer: I think you can make the argument that a lot more resources could have been spent earlier on to clear any of the backlog from early voting. But at the end of the day, the counties really only have so many resources, and they knew that there was going to be a big crush at and after Election Day. So maybe they didn't anticipate that they might need more folks earlier, but maybe they didn't have the resources. And to be honest, election budgets are set well before the election, and these budgets are set well before we knew there were going to be two cards on the ballot. Question: in Yuma, did you end up sending staff to help there? I know that their crunch had a lot to do with resources, people, space. Answer: yeah, same thing in Apache County. I had staff in Apache County. I had five of my staffers up there for like a week, some longer, just because they didn't have the resources. But that doesn't necessarily have to do with planning. It just has to do with the fact that some of these counties are so woefully underfunded by the state government, and none of us have any sustained federal funding. And let's not forget, these are federal elections too, as I've been, you know, pounding on the lectern on Capitol Hill several times. You've got federal elections with federal candidates under federal rules and no sustained federal funding. It is an unfunded mandate, and we have to fix it at the federal and the state level to get the counties to do their jobs. Question: but isn't it also on the state and counties to fund it better? Answer: oh, 100%. I mean, let's look at the presidential preference election, for example. The state government doesn't fully reimburse the counties for this mandatory, party-exclusive exercise. The parties can choose whether or not to participate. It's up to them. The taxpayers have to pay for it, but the counties have to absorb half the cost, which is unreasonable and it's unrealistic. And until we get that dollar amount, which is fixed in statute, changed, we're going to continue to have this problem. Question: so will you be asking for this upcoming legislative session? Answer: we've got a laundry list of things we're going to be asking for this session, and a lot of it has to do with helping the counties do their jobs better. I'm also happily having conversations with members of the legislature to figure out ways that we can do it quicker as well. Question: do you think that all the commotion about the delayed election results is justified? Do you want faster results here? Answer: I don't personally think we need faster results, but this is a democracy, and I'm not the only one who gets to decide. A lot of people want faster results, and I think we can find solutions. But we do have to work together, and I'm more than happy to do that. I've already had conversations with several lawmakers. My role in this conversation will really be as a technical advisor. We want to make sure we're not sacrificing accuracy or access just to get quicker results. Question: but on access, a big part of that is limiting the early voting ballot drop-offs to the Friday before or some point before Election Day. Do you support that? Answer: not without an alternative, not without the capacity for the ballot to be processed one way or the other. I think it's wrong-headed to reduce that access, that last couple of days' worth of access for voters, just to get faster results. So again, if it limits access or limits accuracy, I'm going to be against that solution. But if we can find workarounds and fund them, then of course I'm going to be in support. Question: some of the quickness of the results, though, in the smaller counties has to do with staffing or other mechanical things. So shouldn't counties be taking a look at that, too, to improve the speed? Answer: I spoke with one of the lawmakers who's responsible for purse strings. I'll just characterize it that way. And I said, look, you know, only a couple of our counties tabulate on-site. The vast majority do central tabulation. So you're talking about purchasing an enormous amount of equipment and the training and the staffing that goes along with them, not to mention the maintenance and insurance and storage costs when you're not in the middle of your election cycle. These are considerations that folks like me in my office will be able to bring to the conversation. Question: another thing that came up on Election Day was the bomb threats. Can you talk about what it was like hearing about that for the first time? Answer: well, unfortunately, this office has been dealing with threats for years, and we have a pretty strict protocol and a pathway for that information to flow internally. We trained really well with all of our counties on how to approach this type of information, and the rest was a very smooth flow of information back and forth between law enforcement and election officials in our office and law enforcement at the federal, state, and local level. So I think we dealt with it about as well as one could. And the good thing is, because of that clear communication and the preparation, it didn't expose us to any real delays in voting. Question: what are you taking away from this election? What are you thinking about going into the next cycle? Answer: I think we can fine-tune the preparation that we engaged in. I'm also very grateful for my experience at the county. We have a team here, as you know, that has a whole bunch of former election officials in it, and I think that's the first time in a couple of generations that this office has been as prepared because of that experience. And I feel really, really good about that. So is there some fine-tuning that we can do? Yes. Can we lend some support to help some of the counties move other things in different directions? Absolutely. Question: but there were a few small mistakes, and especially by some of the newer administrators. Do you think that you did lend enough support from this office to make sure that they were ready to go? Answer: there were several examples where we felt like some of the newer folks had little bits of bumps in the road, where they might not have followed the processes that we were recommending. But we don't dictate what happens in the counties. All we can do is lend a hand, lend support, and lend the best training that we can, and we did all of that. Question: all right, switching gears a little bit, in the Washington Post there is a story saying the Department of Justice might, once Trump is in office, investigate, look back at the 2020 election. What's your thought on that? Answer. I mean, when it comes down to it, we know that there's never been a shred of evidence of any wrongdoing in 2020. That would be, what do you call it, spoiled grapes? There's no reason to look back at that stuff. We know that 2020 was great. And how do we know? Because 2022 and 2024 use essentially the same systems, fundamentally the same laws, and mostly the same people. And the voters had a different opinion in 20 than they did in 24. Big deal, right? We've got a lot of other issues in this country that we should be dealing with. And I think a look back that way would just be a waste of time and energy. Question. I have to ask you about the governor's race. Are you considering it? And is it because there's something wrong right now? Let's make it clear. I was approached by folks who were making these suggestions, and I found it to be very complimentary. And you know there's never a reason to say no to the conversation. But I'm focused on being Secretary of State and serving where the Arizona voters have put me. And I'm excited about what the next couple of years hold here. I'm happy with my team, I'm happy with our performance, and I'd like this to reflect a bit on how great of a job we're doing now and not worry about the politics of tomorrow. And that concludes this story, Fontes Vows to Work on Election Funding, Speed. And next to related story, Arizona Certifies 2024 Election Results, Fontes said election denial is, quote, dead, by Jared McDonald Evoy, November 25th, 2024. Arizona officially certified the results of the 2024 election Monday morning. The election results had already been certified at the county levels last week, allowing for the recount process to begin for some races. Unlike in 2020 and 2022, where election denialists attempted to delay or stop the certification process due to unfounded claims of widespread fraud, Monday's canvass went off without any hiccups, leading some to declare the demise of election denialism. I think the age of election denialism, for all intents and purposes, is dead, Secretary of State Adrian Fontes said during the canvass. Claims of election fraud cited by President-elect Donald Trump almost completely disappeared after his decisive win earlier this month. Trump and his allies have been pushing unfounded claims of election fraud for the past 4 years, creating a whole industry around it. Fontes' counterpart in the Attorney General's office disagreed with his take on election denial. I believe I am still dealing with one election challenge from my 2022 race, Mays said, referring to challenges to the results brought by her Republican opponent, Abe Hamadeh, after his narrow defeat. Obviously, we are all aiming toward a return to normalcy, but I am not convinced we are there yet. With the election results officially certified, legal challenges can begin. Fontes's office plans to file orders in court today for the races across the state that were close enough to trigger automatic recounts. The certification opens a 5-day window for candidates to bring lawsuits challenging the election results. Hamadeh and former Fox 10 anchor-turned-Republican politician Carrie Lake both filed lawsuits after their defeats last cycle. Neither lawsuit provided evidence to convince a judge to overturn the results of the election. I can't help but think back to 4 years ago when we certified the last presidential election during backdrop of raging conspiracy theories. Governor Katie Hobbs, who was Secretary of State at the time of the 2020 certification, said, both Hobbs and Mays said they hope there will be a, quote, return to normalcy, and that the certification process can be seen as ministerial and boring again, as opposed to being a beacon for conspiracy theories. This has been an interesting and action-packed election season, which seems to be the norm now, Arizona Supreme Court Chief Justice Ann Timmer said during the certification. This cycle also saw a number of challenges to ballot initiatives that found their ways bouncing back and forth between lower courts and the Arizona Supreme Court with little time before the election. Voter turnout statewide was approximately 78.4%, according to Fontes. Everyone needs to take an example from this election that whether you agree with the results or not, our elections are conducted in a secure and transparent manner, Hobbs said. And that concludes this story. Arizona certifies 2024 election results. Fonte says election denial is dead. Our next article, Congressman Gosar's newsletter, features a conspiracy theory tied to anti-Semitism, by Jared McDonald Devoy, November 25th, 2024. Republican Congressman from Arizona, Paul Gosar, shared a number of conspiracy theories in his official House of Representatives newsletter this week, including one with anti-Semitic ties. This isn't the first time Gosar's newsletter has courted controversy, as twice he has used it to promote websites that shared anti-Semitic messages like Holocaust denialism. In the Prescott Republican's weekly newsletter to constituents, Gosar responded to an email from a surprise man who said he opposed President-elect Donald Trump's nominations of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard to positions in his new administration. Gosar defended former Congresswoman Gabbard, who has been criticized for her lack of experience working with the intelligence community, something Gosar believes makes her right for the job. Many are saying she has no background in the so-called intelligence community that was famously responsible for squashing the Hunter Biden laptop story, fabricating Russiagate, replacing Ukraine's government in 2014, launching a false flag operation on a U.S. naval vessel in coordination with the Israeli government in 1967, perpetrating the Bay of Pigs fiasco, and perhaps even killing President John F. Kennedy, Gosar said in the newsletter. Gosar's defense of Gabbard is full of conspiracy theories, such as Hunter Biden's alleged involvement in a bribery scandal with connections to Russia, as well as myths about the assassination of President Kennedy. His mention of the sinking of the USS Liberty ties to an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Congressman Gosar's reference to the USS Liberty incident as part of a broader critique of the intelligence community in his newsletter is misguided at best and anti-Semitic at worst, Sarah Cater, Deputy Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League's Arizona chapter, said in a statement to the Arizona Mirror. The USS Liberty incident has been historically misused by conspiracy theorists and anti-Semites to promote harmful narratives targeting the Jewish community and the U.S.-Israel relationship, Cater said. Long-standing conspiracy theories about the USS Liberty have been repeatedly debunked, and by referencing it in this context, Gosar perpetrates falsehoods that feed into anti-Semitic tropes and undermines public discourse. Gosar's office did not respond to a request for comment for the story or answer questions about who wrote the congressman's reply in the newsletter. In 2023, Gosar's newsletter linked to an article on a website that had previously posted a video by a famed Holocaust denier and featured the same coded language used by neo-Nazis. Gosar's newsletter has also linked to a different website with an author who promoted a book that claims the Holocaust was a, quote, fraud. The website is heavily pro-Kremlin, often republishing articles from the Russian state-run propaganda websites Russia Today and Sputnik. Iran has recently seized upon USS Liberty conspiracy theories and has used them to amplify hate against Jewish people and Israel. The theories have also been a go-to for neo-Nazis and other anti-Semites. Gosar has long amplified extremists with his platform. In 2021, Gosar promoted the work of known white nationalist Vincent James Fox, who became the unofficial propagandist for a neo-Nazi fight club. Gosar spoke at the same white nationalist conference as Fox a few years earlier, alongside Holocaust denier and anti-Semite Nick Fuentes, the first sitting politician to do so. The work that Gosar promoted mentioned the, quote, Great Replacement Theory, the idea, popular among white supremacists, that white Americans are being replaced by immigrants. It has been seized upon by extremist groups such as the American Identity Movement and generation identity. The Great Replacement Theory has also inspired violence. Fears of immigrants undermining his vision of a white Christian Europe motivated Anders Breivik's murderous rampage in 2011 at a Norwegian youth summer camp. In the U.S., the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh in 2018 was the deadliest attack against the Jewish community in United States history. Just before perpetrating the attack, the killer took to right-wing social media site Gab to say he believed that immigrants were being brought in to replace and, quote, kill our people. The next year in New Zealand, 51 people would be killed and 40 injured, but not before the shooter would post a 74-page manifesto titled The Great Replacement. In 2019, in El Paso, Texas, a shooter who killed 23 in a Walmart would cite the New Zealand shooter's manifesto in one of his own, saying it was a response to the, quote, Hispanic invasion of Texas. Gosar has frequently seized on meme culture used by white supremacists and neo-Nazis on his Twitter account, including the hashtag DarkMAGA movement, which has roots in accelerationist neo-Nazi meme culture, and many memes related to it often express a desire for violence against perceived enemies. In many cases, they are accompanied by neo-Nazi imagery. Gosar's staff said they were unaware of hashtag DarkMAGA until it was brought to their attention by the Mirror. Gosar has also employed two white nationalists in his office. As a public servant, the congressman's words have significant influence, Cater said. We urge him to consider the implication of referencing such narratives and the potential harm they can cause to Jewish Americans, the broader community, and the vital U.S.-Israel alliance. That concludes this story. Congressman Gosar's newsletter features a conspiracy theory tied to anti-Semitism. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. And now, getting back to our Thanksgiving morning edition of the Arizona Mirror, our next story, 8 Supreme Court Applicants Advance to Screening Panel Interviews, by Caitlin Sievers, November 22, 2024. A panel that screens judicial hopefuls winnowed down the applicants to fill a vacant seat on the Arizona Supreme Court to 8 semifinalists on Friday. The new justice, who will be chosen by Governor Katie Hobbs, will replace Republican Robert Brutinel, who retired at the end of October after 14 years on the high court and 28 as a judge. Hobbs will be the first Democrat in more than 15 years to appoint a justice to Arizona's high court. Brutinel was appointed in 2010 by then-Governor Jan Brewer, a Republican. Supreme Court Justice Scott Bales, the last judge appointed by a Democrat, was placed on the court in 2005 by then-Governor Janet Napolitano. He retired in 2019. The Nonpartisan Commission on Appellate Court Appointments, which selects the 8 finalists from 17 applicants, is seeking for public comments on the candidates ahead of the commission's interviews with them, set for December 9th. After the interviews, the commission will recommend at least 3 of the applicants to Hobbs for her to choose from. The commission is required to submit at least 1 nominee to the governor who belongs to a different political party than her. The candidates are Maria Elena Cruz, a Yuma County Democrat who has been an Arizona judge since 2005, currently in the Arizona Court of Appeals. She previously worked as a Yuma County Superior Court judge and for the Yuma and Pima County Attorney's Offices. Nicole C. Davis, a Maricopa County Independent who is the Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Arizona Department of Economic Security. She was previously Deputy General Counsel for Governor Janet Napolitano. D. Andrew Gaona, a Maricopa County Democrat and partner at the Phoenix law firm Coppersmith Brockelman. Gaona has represented Democrats, including Hobbs, in high-profile cases, including Republican Kerry Lake's unsuccessful challenge to the results of the 2022 election for Arizona governor, which she lost to Hobbs. Andrew M. Jacobs, a Maricopa County Democrat who was appointed to the Arizona Court of Appeals in March 2023. Prior to that, he was a partner at Arizona law firm Snell and Wilmer for 20 years. Doreen N. McPaul, a Maricopa County Democrat and Assistant Legislative Attorney for the Tohono O'odham Nation. She is a member of the Navajo Nation and previously served as its Attorney General. Regina L. Nassen, a Pima County Independent and Assistant City Attorney for Tucson. She previously held positions in the Pima County Attorney's Office. Alexander W. Samuels, a Maricopa County Democrat and Deputy Solicitor General for the Arizona Attorney General's Office. He previously held various positions with the United States Attorney's Office. Amy D. Sells, a Maricopa County Democrat and Civil Litigation and Appeals Attorney at the Phoenix office of the law firm Tiffany and Bosco in Phoenix. She's worked for various law firms in the Valley since 2005. Members of the public can submit written comments about the applicants to jnc@courts.az.gov or mail them to 1501 West Washington, Suite 221, Phoenix, Arizona, 85007. To be considered, comments must be received by December 4th and cannot be submitted anonymously. Members of the public can also comment in person on December 9th. The hearing is set for 8:30 a.m. in Conference Room 101 of the Arizona State Courts Building at 1501 West Washington Street in Phoenix. And that's all for this story, 8 Supreme Court Applicants Advanced to Screening Panel Interviews. Next up, after online attacks against her by an incoming school board member, a Mesa teacher is suing. The lawsuit also names conservative bloggers who targeted elementary school teacher Tammy Stass by Joseph Darius Jafari of Lookout, November 21, 2024. When Tammy Stass was first called a, quote, groomer and perverted on a popular far-right blog site, she decided it wasn't worth giving the article any more attention than it already deserved. When another post leaked her name and home address, she still didn't feel like it was worth pushing back or giving the post more publicity. And when she received threatening packages in her mailbox, she again didn't want to give recognition to the groups pushing the harassment. But when they threatened her job as a teacher, a role Stass has worked in for over a decade with elementary students, she decided it was enough. The difference, she told Lookout, was that they came after her ability to make money. "I'm tired, for lack of a better word," Stass said. "I need to not only set the record straight, but it's caused a lot of mental anguish. It's put me through a lot, and I need it to stop." Stass has been the focus of a campaign by owners and authors of far-right websites trying to, as they believe, expose, quote, sexual indoctrination of Arizona students. Indoctrination and grooming, they said, takes the form of First Amendment protections, such as reading books about queer people or expressing themselves publicly. The reason for Stass being the focus is because of her dual role as not only a teacher in the Mesa Unified School District, but also because she leads the Arizona Trans Youth Parent Organization, a local community group aimed at offering support and resources to parents of transgender children. In that role, she has been vocal during state legislative sessions advocating for trans students, and pushing back against State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn's policies limiting access to bathrooms and enforcing a sports ban for transgender girls. Stass said she took on the role by accident when a majority of the parents who led the group before fled the state to protect their children from continued anti-trans legislation brought on by Republican lawmakers. And even though Stass has a trans child herself who has already fled the state, she said leaving Arizona is not an option. "My roots are here," she said. "I have faith in Arizona. I'd like to see a change, and I'm fighting the good fight." But that faith has been considerably challenged for the past 2 years. Some of the articles and posts written about Stass has been shared thousands of times online by accounts run by organizations labeled by the Southern Poverty Law Center as hate groups, including local Moms for Liberty chapters and Libs of TikTok. Now, Stass is suing people associated with those websites who are responsible for using misleading and false information in an alleged attempt to get her fired, including an incoming governing school board member from Mesa Public Schools, Sharon Benson, whose social media is littered with posts blaming LGBTQ+ people for poor academic outcomes across the country. Misleading posts. Named in the lawsuit are Benson, Peggy McLean, Chris Hamlet, and Tamara Farah as defendants. Their spouses are also listed in the claim, but unnamed. Peggy McLean runs the website, quote, "Not in Our Schools," a blog that targets LGBTQ+ teachers and any school policies affirming queer students. Benson is an at-large board member from Mesa Unified School District's governing board after winning her race this past election, and has been supported by Chris Hamlet, a former candidate for the same board who lost his primary. Tamara Farah is one of the leaders with Arizona Women of Action, a small collective of conservatives that have endorsed candidates who attack LGBTQ+ students and make false claims about teachers giving out sexually inappropriate content in an attempt to stop lessons that may include any reference to LGBTQ+ people. Farah also writes opinion stories for AZ Free News, a conservative news site that peddles conspiracy theories about gender ideology being taught in the state schools. The site is overseen by former and current members of conservative legislative policy groups. Stass' civil lawsuit in the Maricopa County Superior Court says McLean used Not in Our Schools to spread misinformation about her teaching style and curriculum, including teaching pronouns. McLean's blog has a modest following. A similar web report of her website shows that her posts only garner roughly 1,000 views a month. But her posts are often shared on the social media platform X with the website's 3,000 followers that include State Representative Jacqueline Parker, former Maricopa County Attorney candidate Gina Godbehar, and current Congressman-elect Abe Hamadeh. In multiple posts, McLean accused Stass, who teaches third and fourth grade, of pedophilia for hanging a pride flag in her room and teaching kids about pronouns, specifically the singular form of the pronoun they. The post referenced Stass and another teacher, saying they are not shy about explaining how they influence their students in the classroom to accept their twisted view of sex. The June 30th post referred to the teachers as demonic and Stass specifically as perverted. That post, according to Stass' lawsuit, influenced Benson, who was a former teacher with Mesa Public Schools, to comment online that she would have the expectation employees teach state standards, and echoed McLean's statements that Stass was teaching sex and sexuality to her students. Multiple times, Benson has shared anti-LGBTQ+ content from Not in Our Schools. On her personal social media pages, Benson has also blamed the election loss of Kamala Harris on transgender staffers in the White House. In August, Not in Our Schools posted how a Mesa high school teacher had a, quote, pledge to listen to students' needs patiently and without judgment to the best of my ability. McLean's post claimed the pledge and the rainbow sticker together was evidence of an LGBTQ agenda and sexual agenda. Benson also shared that post, which named Stas multiple times as the district's LGBTQ ringleader. Benson commented that activists are stealing the future away from innocent children and causing confusion. In response, the Mesa Unified School District conducted an investigation and found no wrongdoing. Stas' lawsuit said Benson and McLean were given that report, but continued to post about Stas in an attempt to harm her employment. Benson used to be an employee of Mesa Unified before she retired last year. In her position as a teacher, she was also a mandated reporter, someone who is legally required to contact legal authorities if they believe a child is being sexually assaulted or groomed. Before Stas filed her lawsuit, Benson showed up to a Mesa Unified School District board meeting in September and spoke in opposition to being inclusive of LGBTQ plus students and said that it was inappropriate. But a review of public-facing investigations from the Arizona Department of Child Safety shows Stas has not been investigated for any illegal activity, and there have been no known complaints filed by Benson despite her legal duty to report inappropriate behavior. That is because Ms. Benson knew there was no validity to any of her accusations, Stas' lawyer said in the lawsuit. After winning her election and being served the lawsuit, Benson wrote a post that threatened writing up teachers for insubordination and how truth and virtue will win out if we are vigilant and courageous. Defamation trickle-down. It's unclear how the defamation lawsuit, if Stas wins, will affect the practices of websites such as AZ Free News, which claims on its website to be the number one source for Arizona news and politics. Not in Our Schools makes no claim to be a news website, but is often quoted as source material for AZ Free News, and McLean has written opinion pieces for the website before. AZ Free News is published by the Arizona Freedom Foundation, a nonprofit based out of Gilbert that makes claims on advancing independent and investigative news in Arizona. Though neither AZ Free News nor the foundation are affiliated, registered, or certified by any news affiliates, such as the Institute for Nonprofit News, Arizona Media Association, or LION Publishers, that establishes standards for the industry. Its executive director and managing editor, Eric Porteous, was the former director of digital marketing for the Alliance Defending Freedom, a group that opposes LGBTQ plus rights and has been labeled as a Christian-based hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. AZ Free News' board also includes members of conservative policy groups, including the Goldwater Institute. One post from Libs of TikTok, an online social media account with a sizable following that inspired bomb threats to libraries and children's hospitals, reposted an opinion piece from AZ Free News, written by Tom Rafara, that shares Stas' personal information that resulted in Stas receiving threatening messages, according to the lawsuit. Farah has written multiple op-ed pieces for AZ Free News that make false claims about LGBTQ plus people in public schools and is against them celebrating community holidays such as Trans Day of Remembrance. Stas' lawsuit, which Brick Road Coffee in Tempe is helping to fundraise for and offset costs, would be one of a recent wave of cases filed against far-right news websites that have been forced to remove articles, publicly apologize, or pay out damages to people and companies who have been on the receiving end of misleading and false news articles posted about the 2020 election being stolen from then-President Donald Trump. Since Stas' lawsuit, AZ Free News has added a clarification to the top of Farah's opinion piece from August this year, saying that the language to describe grooming or sexualizing children is not meant to be taken literally. The reference to sexually grooming kids concerns encouraging LGBTQIA gender identity considerations. Further, the mention of sexualizing kids refers specifically to encouraging kids to access the specific library books indicated and not to anything else. Benson, McLean, and Farah would not respond to Lookout's request for comments. And that concludes this story. After online attacks against her by an incoming school board member, a Mesa teacher is suing. Our next story, Rio Verde man sentenced to 15 months in prison for threatening elected federal officials, by Gloria Rebecca Gomez, November 26, 2024. An Arizona man will spend a year and 3 months in prison for making violent threats online against elected and federal officials. On Monday, United States District Judge Dominic Lanza sentenced Michael Lee Tomasi, a 38-year-old resident of Rio Verde, to 15 months in prison and 36 months of supervised release. He will also be required to pay a $100 fine for publishing threatening social media posts last year on Patriots.win, an online forum for supporters of President-elect Donald Trump. In his post, Tomasi called for the execution of a congressman, wrote about his urge to rape a congresswoman, and threatened to kill FBI agents. "Shoot the FBI first and ask questions later. They are terrorists that deserve nothing but to be shot on sight," Tomasi wrote in one such post in August 2023. "Any FBI have a problem with that, come to my house and see what happens. Shoot before they even pull their guns out of their trunk, and you shoot to kill." When FBI agents arrested Tomasi in December, they found more than 5,000 rounds of ammunition, several firearms, including an AR-15-style rifle, and body armor. Lanza ordered that ammunition and weapons will not be returned to Tomasi. Attorney General Merrick Garland applauded Monday's sentencing and thanked FBI agents for bringing Tomasi to justice. "After making vile threats to execute and sexually assault FBI agents and employees, state and local law enforcement officials, and other public servants, Michael Tomasi told the FBI to come to my house and see what happens. What has happened is that he will spend 15 months in a federal prison," Garland wrote in a news release. Originally charged with 3 counts of threatening federal officials and 3 counts of making interstate threats, Tomasi faced a maximum of 15 years in prison and a $250,000 fine for each count. In the end, he pled guilty to 1 count of making threats against public officials. FBI Director Christopher Wray criticized the attacks against agents and officials that work on behalf of the public's interest. "I take it very personally that anyone would threaten FBI personnel who work tirelessly to protect the American people from a variety of threats and often put themselves in harm's way while carrying out their duties," he said. U.S. Attorney Gary Restaino warned that threats against public officials will not go unpunished and said there's a clear difference between freedom of speech and violent statements. "Civil discourse and civil dialogue are fundamental to a democratic society," he said, "but the incitement of violence is not. We will continue our efforts to prosecute those who make true threats against public officials and law enforcement officers." Over the past decade, studies have found a marked increase in political violence and threats targeting public officials, particularly locally elected figures. Experts attribute that rise to heightened partisanship and an increase in violent political rhetoric. And that concludes this story, Rio Verde man sentenced to 15 months in prison for threatening elected federal officials. We're going to be ending today's show with a health note. Biden administration unveils plan to cover weight loss meds under Medicare, Medicaid, by Jennifer Shute, November 26, 2024. the Biden administration announced Tuesday it's reinterpreting federal law to allow Medicare and Medicaid patients access to anti-obesity medications to reduce their weight over the long term. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid's proposed rule, which the Trump administration would need to finalize before it would take effect, is expected to cost $25 billion for Medicare, combined with $11 billion in federal spending, and $3.8 billion in state spending for Medicaid coverage throughout the next decade. CMS is encouraging states to submit comments to the proposed rule explaining when they could implement the Medicaid provision, since that health care program includes cost sharing between federal and state governments. Medicare is the federal health insurance program for people 65 and older and some younger people with certain disabilities or conditions. Medicaid provides health care to some low-income individuals. People with obesity deserve to have affordable access to medical treatment and support, including anti-obesity medications for this disease, just as a person with type 2 diabetes can access these medications to get healthy, CMS Administrator Chiquita Brooks-LaShore said on a call with reporters. That's why we're proposing to revise our interpretation of the law and provide coverage of anti-obesity medications for the treatment of obesity. Brooks-LaShore said CMS was reinterpreting the law to view obesity as a chronic condition, which the agency believes provides a pathway for Medicare and Medicaid to cover anti-obesity medications. The medical community today agrees that obesity is a chronic disease, Brooks-LaShore said. It is a serious condition that increases the risk of premature death and can lead to other serious health issues such as heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. More than 40% of Americans have obesity, and CMS data shows 22% of Medicare recipients were diagnosed with obesity during 2022, double the number from 10 years ago, she said. CMS wrote in a fact sheet about the proposed rule that since creation of the Medicare Part D program, which provides prescription drug coverage, the agency has interpreted the statutory exclusion of agents when used for weight loss to mean that a drug, when used for weight loss, is excluded from the definition of a covered Part D drug. And we're going to have to end it there because that's all the time we have for this week's edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Did you know if you missed any part of this program or want to hear a story again, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and click on Demand Podcasts. You can also take Sun Sounds with you by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Stay tuned for more great programming from Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining us. We wish you all a happy Thanksgiving, and we look forward to seeing you next week.